Thanks, Marcus. So I will be responding in my talk to some claims that Marcus Hutter might make tomorrow. So it's pretty unfortunate actually that his talk doesn't precede this one, because, well, I think I'll be replying to points he will make, but also I will be assuming some familiarity with the concepts of the field. So we'll have to see on the fly whether I need to improvise a little bit and spend some more time on those things. So please do interrupt me if I'm skipping over over definitions and details. All right. So yeah, the goal of this talk is to take a more critical perspective towards two main conceptual philosophical associations with the predictive variant of algorithmic information theory. So these associations are roughly connected to two different, though as it turns out, formally equivalent definitions of a universal a priori probability measure that gives a universal prediction method. So the first definition is oh, I am now operating my browser. Yeah. So the first definition goes back to Solomonov, 64. It's basically a probability distribution to, that assigns probability to finite sequences in terms of how short of a description they have via a universal Turing machine. So intuitively how compressible they are, which leads to this association that this definition, when used as a prediction method, gives an objective implementation of Occam's razor in prediction. Secondly, definition that goes back basically to Levine's work in the 70s. He was a student of Kolmogorov. Of a definition that is explicitly a weighted mean or a Bayesian mixture over a large class of effectively computable probability measures, which gives a priori universal distribution and a universal prediction method. So one, I think, important insight of the field is that these two definitions, they look quite different, but they are actually formally equivalent in the sense that if I define a Solomonov algorithmic probability distribution using some universal Turing machine, so I have to fix some kind of universal Turing machine to define it, then this is actually the exact same function, essentially the same function as the function I would get by defining a Levin mixture with some weight function, or on a Bayesian interpretation, some prior distribution to the elements of this class, and the other way around. So they really identify the same countable class of functions. And in particular, to repeat, it's a nice observation that the choice of universal Turing machine really corresponds to your choice of Bayesian prior weight function over this this large class. Okay, but I will go into both definitions in more detail later. So the plan of the talk is to first focus on the Levin definition and ask the question, does it really give us a convincing specification of a universal method of prediction? That's part one of the talk. In part two, I will look at more closely at the Solomonov definition and ask the question, does it really give a convincing implementation of Occam's razor? And in both cases, I will argue not. So it will be pretty negative talk. This is based on my PhD thesis that I completed actually in January. All right, so first say a little bit about the setting I'm assuming. So we are assuming a setting of prediction of binary, of a developing infinite binary sequence. So every trial we have seen a finite sequence of bits, and we have to predict what bit comes next. So formally, we are using a prediction method that is a function from finite sequences, the sequences we've seen so far, to a distribution over the two next possible outcomes. And it's an important fact, I sort of alluded to it already, that prediction methods really correspond to probability measures over the whole infinite tree, over the whole Cantor space. Given a measure of the Cantor space by conditionalizing on finite sequences, I basically get a prediction method, and the other way around, given a prediction method by chain rule of conditional probabilities or predictions, I get a full measure. Here I am assuming that there are no probability zero involved in the measure.
What is Cantor space?
Cantor space is here. I keep it a little bit informal, but when I say Cantor space, I just mean the infinite tree of infinite binary sequence. Yeah.
The infinite tree of finite binary sequences.
Infinite sequences.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So a universal prediction method. What should we aim for when we aim for a universal prediction method? So one way of trying to make this precise is to say it should be universally reliable, which intuitively should mean that whatever the actual sequence, the method should be able to learn the pattern in the data and sort of convert that into successful predictions, which you can make precise, for instance, in a loss function that measures how much the predictions are off from the actual outcomes. And then you should want to say something like the losses go to zero, say. There are various ways in which you can make that precise. But however you make that precise, it's quite clear that this is in general impossible. Right? For any method I define, any method you give me, I can come up with sequences it will never be able to be successful on. Basically, I can employ all kinds of diagonal arguments. And in a way, this all goes back to the original problem of induction due to Hume. And the lesson that philosophers have generally taken from this difficulty is that it's simply impossible to make predictions, make inferences without making inductive assumptions. So without, from the start, restricting what can happen. From the start, making assumptions on what nature could do at all. And then at least aim for reliability relative to those possibilities. But that, of course, goes a little bit against this ambitious aim of a really universal prediction method. But there is another more feasible looking way we can construct this aim, we can understand this aim, and this is in terms of optimality, by which I mean that instead of aiming to converge on successful predictions always, we aim to converge on successful predictions whenever this is possible at all. Which we make precise by whenever some prediction method would have been successful. So basically what this comes down to, it's inspired by the way Reichenbach tried to approach the problem of induction. But what it formally comes down to is that instead of making inductive assumptions on the world, we make some reasonable restriction on what possible prediction methods could ever do. And this looks more feasible, mainly for the following reason. The reason being that it seems natural to place a restriction of computability on possible prediction methods. So this is an essential move in the field, the restriction to computability. So it seems plausible to say that any possible prediction methods we could ever come up with should at least be implementable on a computer, should at least be capturable in a algorithm, should at least be computable in the Turing sense. And this is a very nice kind of restriction because intuitively it's super wide, but formally it's a highly restrictive assumption, since there are only countably many algorithms, there are only countably many computable elements, so it's a massive restriction from a mathematical point of view. But then the optimality aim would be to converge on successful predictions whenever some computable prediction method would. So this is then the goal, to define a function such that whenever some computable prediction method is successful, so for every sequence on which at least some computable method would be successful, this function should be successful too, which we can again make precise in terms of the losses, for instance. So if some function manages to make its losses go to zero on the sequence, then we should too. Now, constructed as such, this is actually super easy to do. And the way we can do this is just to take an explicit weighted mean over all those computable elements. So take this class of all computable probability measures, or all computable prediction methods, and just define this mixture, this weighted mean, with a weight function that has a sum to one, and which we can interpret in a Bayesian fashion if you want, as a prior probability assignment to the different elements. And the corresponding measure, the corresponding prediction method, has first of all the property that if one of these computable elements actually generates the data, we are sure with probability one to converge on the actual probabilities. But also in the optimality sense, if one of these computable prediction methods is successful on a sequence, then we will be too, in a very strong sense. So that is nice. That's then seems to be the end of the story. Here we have it, a universal prediction method. But now I will argue that it's not. So again, the kind of argument I try to make, or sort of the aim I set ourselves, is to isolate this class of prediction methods with the claim that we can identify this class with all possible prediction methods. So I make the claim that all computable prediction methods can be identified with all possible prediction methods. And now I want a method that is optimal over this class. But what I also want is that this method is itself still in this class. It should itself still be an actual prediction method.
Wouldn't you want to use all enumerable measures then instead?
Sorry?
Wouldn't you, if you use enumerability instead?
You're ahead of us. that's the step I will take next, yeah. So this is impossible for the computable measures or prediction method. This is actually an argument that goes back to Putnam when he, in an influential paper against Carnap's project of inductive logic. It's quite easy to see that this is impossible. So for any computable prediction method you propose, computable, I can just make a diagonal sequence as follows. Every trial I just calculate what you predict, since you have a computable method. And if you say probability higher than a half to say one, I just play zero, and the other way around. And note that the way I do this is computable itself. I can calculate your predictions and in a computable way diagonalize. So I'm actually constructing a computable sequence in this way that your method will never be able to predict successfully on. And this also means, since it's a computable sequence, there is some other simple method, some other computable methods that will be successful in this sequence. So this is basically a reductio of the possibility of a universal method in this sense. Now, and then we are finally going to the Levin definition, because this definition we can understand as an explicit attempt to try and avoid this diagonalization by expanding to a class of effective measures in a weaker sense. So in a way, this is kind of the same thing that's already happened in the original Turing paper, where Turing, of course, considered the partial computable functions. And the partial computable functions, as opposed to the total computable functions, are not diagonalizable. So the property of partiality sort of protects it from diagonalization. And this also opens up the possibility of a universal Turing machine. And basically the idea is to try to make the same kind of move, but then in the setting of computable measures. And if we try to weaken the notion of computable measure in this way, we end up with a notion of a semi-computable, a lower semi-computable measure, a measure of which we cannot compute the probability values. We cannot, for any given accuracy, compute the value up to that accuracy, but we at least have an algorithm that approximates from below. So that gives increasingly accurate approximations of the probability. And to be fully complete, to not make this collapse to computability again, we actually also need to change the notion of measure a little bit here in this kind of funny notion of semi-measure. I won't go in detail here. It's a bit of a funny notion. I might say a little bit later more about this. I think that's actually also a problematic thing. But anyway, so this is the old picture, the class of computable or delta one measures with this universal element that must be outside. And the idea is to weaken this notion, to get a bigger class, and a universal element for this class is actually still within the class. So this Levin definition, this mixture over all semi-computable elements is still semi-computable. It's still within this class. So if we make this conceptual identification of all feasible, all prediction methods with all semi-computable elements, then it seems we're good. However, well, one thing one could say is that it doesn't seem very natural to use this notion of semi-computability and semi-measure. I will say a little bit more about that maybe later. But there is a more profound reason why this doesn't work after all. And this is the fact that we are actually interested not so much in the measures on Cantor's case. We are actually interested in the prediction methods. In the case of computable measures, this doesn't make a difference. So for computable any computable measure corresponds to its computable. For every computable measure, its conditional measure is still computable. The corresponding predictor is still computable. But in the case of semi-computable measures, we lose this. So if we conditionalize on a semi-computable measure, what happens is that we have a fraction of semi-computable terms. And this fraction itself does not need to be semi-computable itself any longer. So in particular, the Solomonov-Levin prediction method, so if we turn this Levin mixture into a prediction method, is no longer a semi-computable element. It's even higher in the compute, in the arithmetical hierarchy. So again, the picture looks more like this. So we have here all semi-computable prediction methods, and the universal element is still outside of this class. And well, we can generalize this to further levels in the arithmetical hierarchy. Yeah.
Sorry for interrupting. And again, there's a version by Vitani where he constructs conditional distributions and the universality inside of them.
Yeah. That still falls under the Putnam argument. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So even if you identify, so this is what I take you to suggest now. So even if you identify all prediction methods with semi-computable prediction methods, right? There's then the universal element for that class is not in that class.
Oh, I thought it is, but we can check.
No.
It's another definition, maybe. Yeah.
Let's chat about that. But, yeah, if you just define it as the conditional measure should be semi-computable, and you take the class of all of those, and something that's universal for that, then falls outside. Yeah. So in a strong sense, it's really just impossible to define a universal prediction method on this, I think, reasonable reconstruction of the aim And in particular, the Solomonov-Levin definition really doesn't give a universal. Let me just sort of finish this part off by having a somewhat closer look at this funny notion of a semi-computable method. So let's get some feeling for what this problematic here. Consider the notion of a partial computable prediction method for categorical prediction. So instead of probabilities, we issue zeros and ones for prediction. Now this doesn't really seem like a very feasible prediction method because it might be undefined at some trials, right? It's partial. So if we would actually go and use it, then at each trial we would either have to be prepared to wait forever, and it's certainly not the universal method. Or at some point just stop waiting and issue a default prediction. And depending on whether we do this in a computable way, in which case it would just collapse to a total computable function again, or we do this in some funny incomputable way, in which case it is no longer a partial computable function, we will lose universality again. And now, with a semi-computable prediction method, it looks superficially that we're in a slightly better place because things are not undefined here. It's not partial. It's just that we cannot, the values it gives are defined. We just cannot approximate it effectively. But if you look at it, we're really in the same kind of spot because we have to make a decision when we stop approximating and issue that prediction. And again, if we never stop approximating it, then we're stuck. If we do, then depending on how we make this decision when to stop, we either end up with a fully computable measure again, or with something that is no longer even semi-computable. So actually, this notion is already highly problematic, even if this diagonal argument wouldn't destroy its use. Okay, but that's a little bit of a technical point. So that concludes part one, which is maybe a good moment to take some questions, if there are any. Otherwise, I'll just...
Do you already know what Marcus Hutter would have responded now?
No.
We'll find out tomorrow.
Yeah, hopefully. So I think the sort of the way it's normally presented, the Solomonov definition, is just saying, look, it converges to all computable measures, and it is itself still semi-computable. So it's kind of it does what we want because all computable measures are supposed to be the reasonable ones, and it's still kind of effective. And I think this sort of questions the second point. This is maybe going to be a little bit of a long story.
Sorry to be that. Can you just say again what semi-computable means?
Yeah. So a semi-computable function is a function from, let's say, rationals to reals. Let's contrast it with a computable function. So for a computable function, for any input, we can specify a level of accuracy, and this function will give the output up to that level of accuracy. With a semi-computable method, we give a level of approximation, so to say, which is an integer, as we increase this level of approximation, we get closer from below to the actual value. But we don't know how close we actually are. So it gets closer and closer and closer, but we might always be pretty far off. We don't know how this. Yeah.
But isn't it a matter of experience that most things that can be shown to converge reasonably fast in reality? I mean,
yeah.
There are so many contexts in science where we work with asymptotic statements like complexity theory in computer science.
Yeah.
And people say, oh, that doesn't make sense because you don't know the constants. But usually the constants are not that high that they spoil the argument.
Yeah, sure, but I'm not really sure what's...
I mean, well, because you say we signed to waiting forever. Of course, can't wait forever, but there's a reasonable time after which you can be pretty sure.
Okay, but that gives you a procedure to stop it at some point. And then it just collapses to a computable method. And then it's no longer universal.
True, but still, it could be a good approximation. That's a lot of discussion.
Yeah, no, it's a pretty profound difficulty. Yes, of course, I agree with you. If you can be happy with approximations, but as soon as we have some way of deciding when to stop, it's just a computable method we are using. So it's no, it cannot be universal.
So with this semi-computable prediction, is it true that we could get convergence to the right answer, but we just won't, it won't be effective convergence, we just won't know ever know how close we are to the right answer?
With the semi-computable, yeah.
Okay, that might be good enough for Hutter. We'll see what he says tomorrow. I have to ask him.
So, is this related to a semi-computable function, which, as I understand, should be a function that can be implemented, so it can be computed on a Turing machine, only in the sense that if the answer is yes, then the Turing machine will stop and give that answer, but if the answer is no, then it may never stop. So is it the same concept?
Yeah, I mean, it's formally related to that. To the notion of computable enumerability. That's what you were saying here. Yeah.
Recursive.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Basically the way that... So the notion of semi-computability corresponds to the notion of partial computable when you're looking at functions from integers to integers. And that kind of corresponds to this notion of computable enumerability that you just mentioned. So on a formal level, depending on what kind of object you're looking at, it's the same kind of effective. That makes things a little bit clearer.
So if I have a random, like if I just stop at random at every computation step, with maybe a low probability or something, what would that correspond?
If it's truly random, okay. So suppose you're using a Solomonov function and you randomly decide when to stop. I think a lot of funny things could actually happen. I never really thought about this question, but I mean, it does mean that at some point you just cut off the approximation. So let me put it like this. The convergence results are really phrased in terms of the actual probabilities, right? The actual probabilities that are sort of the end of the approximation. So if you have some way of sort of cutting that off and just giving the approximation you have now, I don't have much intuition for what would happen. I mean, might be the case, also depending on how you... It might be the case that it will not converge. It can come up with sequences. I think that will actually be so, that you can come up with sequences such that the semi-computable measure converges on it, but for some chosen cutting off procedure, those values will actually not converge on it. Yeah, so I think it's actually pretty difficult problem. Yeah.
Again, what convergence means?
So, in this optimality interpretation, convergence, it's better to look at it like this, because you are comparing yourself to competing prediction methods. So there's not really some truth that you assume that you can converge to. So it's rather like this. You have some loss function that measures how far your predictions are off from the actual outcomes, and you want that your loss function, your losses, will converge or even get less than the losses of this other method. So that's the kind of convergence here. Yeah. So this, for instance, might be possible that this other method is doing super bad. It has massive losses, and you have massive losses too, but just needs to be below that of the first one. Yeah, so I proceed with the second part. All right, so this is the association with Occam's razor. So let me first just go into the definition in a little bit detail, because it's important. Okay, maybe start with this set. So fix some universal Turing machine. This set of the shortest descriptions of Y via U are all shortest sequences that we input, that we give to U, as a result of which it outputs this string Y, this sequence Y. And okay, I should also mention here that we're using a slightly non-standard notion of a Turing machine here, a so-called monotone Turing machine, that can be seen as a sort of dynamic machine that takes a sequence, developing sequence of symbols, and on the fly outputs a developing sequence of symbols. But the set of descriptions for sequence Y are those X, those shortest X we feed the monotone Turing machine, such that it outputs at least Y, such that it outputs sequence that starts with Y. So intuitively, those are the things we feed to the machine to make it produce our sequence Y. Okay, so that is that set. So now, given a sequence Y, the algorithmic probability of Y is the sum over all those descriptions of this term 2 to the minus the length of this description. So intuitively, what happens here is that Y gets higher probability as it has shorter descriptions. Now, you could remark it will also have high probability if it has a lot of descriptions. But there is actually a theorem, coding theorem, called, that says that if there are a lot of short descriptions, there's also a single short description or a couple of very short descriptions. So this really means like it really tries to make this link between high probability and short descriptions, or on a further interpretative level, Y gets higher probability as it's more compressible or as it is simpler. So if we then turn this definition into a prediction method just by conditionalizing, then we see that the extensions of a given sequence get higher probability as they are more compressible. So you give higher probability to the next symbol that makes the sequence simple, which is normally interpreted as a clear implementation of Occam's razor in prediction. So that is the Solomonov prediction. Are there any questions about the definition? So in order to think about it in some more detail, I just want to go through this notion of, I just want to take a little bit of a closer look at the notion of compressibility, the notion of coding system here. So I will simplify things a little bit. I will try to explain what a coding system is. Now we'll use a notion that is actually a little bit simpler as the one that is used in the previous definition. But the conceptual points I will try to get at carry over. So what is a coding system, or simply a code? Well, we have some set, and I will just take them as finite sequences again. I will take the set as a set of finite sequences again. and we want to map these all these elements to some description. So a code is a function that takes a source sequence and maps it to a description. And this is normally done in such a way that no description is a prefix of another, which guarantees some, is a, yeah, provides a guarantee of some unique decodability. And a code comes then with a code length function that takes a sequence and then returns the length of its description. Right? Now it's a fundamental fact in information theory that codes and probability distributions on finite sequences are in some sense equivalent. Namely, for every code, this function 2 to the minus the code length actually gives a probability assignment. And conversely, for every probability assignment on finite sequences, there is some code that does, with some rounding off, corresponds. So in a way, we can treat them as equivalent. And the same observation holds for probability measures on the whole Cantor space and the more complicated notion of a coding system that is actually used in the Solomonov. All right. Now, if Y has a small code length, then one could say that this function C compresses Y, right? Gives a shorter description. One could even say that Y is simple to C. But of course, this is a very relative notion. It's really an expression how well we have explicitly made this sequence be fit by C. And taking this equivalence with probability distribution, it's really equivalent to, of course, the corresponding probability distribution's likelihood given Y or its goodness of fit for Y. So how can we turn this into a more absolute, non-relative function? Well, then we get to the notion of a universal coding system. So given some class of codes, a universal code for this class is such that it's almost as good as any code in it, meaning that for any code C in this class, there's only an overhead constant such that for every source sequence Y, the universal description length, so the description length via this universal code of Y, does not exceed the description length of this first code in the class C more than this overhead. So intuitively, a universal code for C represents the full class in the sense that if some code in this class gives a sequence a short description, then this universal code will do up to the overhead. So in a way, another way of phrasing it is kind of the universal code emulates any other in this class. But again, universality is a little bit of a misnomer here because of course, it all depends, it's all relative still to this class of codes we begin with. So again, it's equivalent really to the goodness of fit of a mixture of a class of distributions, right? In the same way, this mixture that I mentioned in the first part that we can also define over any countable class of distributions, we can understand as representing this class in the sense that if some distribution gives a high probability to one of to a sequence, then this mixture will give a high probability to the sequence too, up to in this case the weight or the prior that is actually assigned to the element. So my point here is actually that we're kind of retracing the story in the first part. We are again sort of moving towards this aim of a universal class for which we want to define a universal code in this case. Very much analogous to the earlier project of identifying a universal class of probability measures for which we wanted to have a universal element. So again, truly universal compressibility must again be found in this class of all effectively computable elements. We're kind of in the same project again. But one thing I didn't really talk about in the first part was this aspect of that we were really looking at the asymptotics of things, right? And that is what happens here too. And this is what is, I think, a little bit more of a problem in this association with simplicity. So let me make this a little bit more precise.
Can I ask a question about your penultimate point?
Sorry?
This the idea that a mixture represents the full class.
Yeah.
But you also said that a single instance represents the full class in the same way.
A single instance? What
yeah, any element of a class represents it. Is it also true?
I mean here it represents the class in the sense that if the sign's high probability, then the mixture does too. So the other way around.
No, I mean just any member of the class represents the class in the same way, doesn't it?
Not necessarily. No.
Okay. Well.
Yeah. So the other way. So it's basically the other way around. Right? I mean, if a class gives a high probability to something, then a particular element in the class might still give a very low probability to it. I mean, it's a bit informal what I mean here by the use of the word representing, but the way I defined it here, it doesn't go the other way. Yeah, okay, so, and this is basically the issue of variance. So in my definition of a universal code, I'm talking about overhead constants, and I'm not specifying how they should actually be picked. And in the same way, I didn't say anything about how actually this universal machine in the algorithmic probability distribution should be chosen. I didn't say anything about how these Bayesian weights should actually be chosen in the universal mixture. But if it's the case that we can just choose anything, choose any universal code we like, that is as valid as the next one, isn't it the problem that this makes such a choice and thereby definition rather arbitrary? At least as applied to finite elements. So let's try to see how we can answer this question. So one move one could try to make is say, well, it's not the case that any universal code is as valid as the next one. There are privileged objective choices of overhead constants, of universal Turing machines, of weights in the universal mixture. And there have been some attempts to sort of identify that. But it seems pretty hard, and I guess this sort of corresponds to the intuition in Bayesian statistics, where there, of course some priors are more natural than others, and there are crazy priors. But it's quite hard, at least for countably infinite classes, to really specify in all generality a privileged class of most objective priors. And in the same way, the literature on choosing a reasonable universal Turing machine also always retains this kind of hand-wavingness. There's not really a principled way of identifying such a thing. Marcus has a paper on trying to isolate the natural universal Turing machine for the solar mode of definition. Your conclusion is also basically like the pretty profound reasons why this just doesn't work. So that doesn't really seem a way out. And actually, the standard reply in the field is the following. It's basically saying, it doesn't really matter, this invariance, because we still have that any two choices are equivalent up to an additive in the case of codes, or multiplicative constant in the case of distributions. And this is because the universal element is contained in the class, so any first universal element also emulates the second universal element because it's in the class, and the other way around. So in that sense, they are pretty close. And this observation has indeed generally been taken as sort of the starting point of the field. Like there is an important invariance here. And that is true, certainly true from an asymptotic perspective. So this is Kolmogorov. the bearing of the inference theorem is that from an asymptotic perspective, complexity doesn't depend on accidental properties of the chosen optimal method. So this kind of corresponds to a perspective where I fix some universal code, you fix another, and together we are investigating the complexity of a sequence as it grows. And as the sequence grows and its complexities grow, this constant difference in our assessments don't really, they start to make less and less of a difference, right? So in that sense, it doesn't really make a difference. But I could also take this perspective. We have gotten some finite sequence and we are interested in its complexity. Well, I fix some universal code and I give some assessment. And then you have the freedom to choose for any divergence some universal code that makes it that much different in its complexity. So from this perspective, it's actually quite serious. So then you sort of get into discussion, what is the right perspective here, which is again, in this super general setting, a little not very satisfying discussion. But anyway, I think it's fair to say that the perspective that is taken in the field is that at least we have a good measure of the order of complexity, right? So these constant differences don't really matter if we just want to distinguish the order of the complexity of an infinite string, if you just want to distinguish sequences that have complexity order, linear order, or a logarithmic, or a constant complexity. And this is fine, and this gives a nice theory. But I don't think it's really enough for this, if we go back all the way, for this association with Occam's razor in this prediction method, where it's really about individual predictions, and the claim is that we are really steering towards simpler strings in our individual predictions. And then we really need a notion of simplicity for finite sequences, and that is not given here. So to close off with somewhat more fake intuition from working with all this stuff for some time. So the basic goal here is, in all those definitions, is to come up with a universal element, right? The universal code, the universal distribution, universal mixture. But the intuition is such an extremely permissive notion in the following sense. For every further association I want to make, conceptual association I want to make in some definition. So I give you a definition of universal element and I say, look, if you look at this definition, it clearly has, say, a simplicity bias. But then this notion of universality gives me so much freedom that I can give an equivalent definition that just loses this association, that is just sufficiently different that it's no longer there. And I will give you an example. So consider again the definition of the algorithmic probability distribution, which we can equivalently write as follows. So the 2 to the minus the length of the string is just its uniform probability. So we can write it as this. It's uniform. It's the sum of the uniform probabilities of its descriptions. So the picture that is often evoked here is like, it gives the probabilities you would get if you would feed this machine uniformly distributed input. And this clearly, so here can imagine someone saying, look, it's clear that there's a simplicity, a compressibility interpretation here. Because look, shorter strings get higher probability, right? So this is how this original compressibility interpretation started out, in my mind. But this really hinges on the unique property of the uniform measure that it always gives shorter strings higher probability. But now I can do the following: give me any computable distribution. Any continuous computable distribution, I can plug it in the definition, and I still get the exact same class of definitions, the exact same class of algorithmic probability distribution. So this is how much freedom the choice of universal Turing machine actually gives me to change this definition in such a way that I think in this instance, this association with compressibility is somewhat lost. Yeah. So this is not a conclusive argument. There's still debate possible on what are the right intuitions. But I do think that as it stands, the case that algorithmic probability gives a natural implementation of Occam's razor is pretty inconclusive. This I will say. So the conclusion is that I think the Solomonov definition really doesn't give a convincing specification of the universal prediction. But I really think these diagonal arguments sort of show that this is impossible. And I also think that it doesn't really give a convincing implementation. So that was it. Thank you.
Thanks for a great talk. Well, I would have some general remarks on how we use infinity in physics.
Mm-hmm.
But let's take your example first, or continue on our discussion that you said if you stop the prediction scheme somewhere, you end up with something that is computable.
Yeah.
But I would say, okay, but however, it may be a computable scheme that you wouldn't have found without the crazy idea of Solomonov's prior. So couldn't it be that, in general, I would say infinity is just a fairy tale that inspires us
mm-hmm.
to come up with good solutions for large finite things.
Right. Yeah. it all depends on what you take the project to be, right? I mean, if you're unhappy with infinities to the point that you're not so interested in the aim of always convergence to good predictions in some natural subclass of cases, then you disagree with the whole project, I would say. Then it doesn't. Then the aim of looking for a universal prediction method is kind of misguided from the start. Right?
Yeah, you just take it with a grain of salt.
Sorry?
You just take it with a grain of salt. It's not.
Yeah.
I mean, we use infinite arguments everywhere. Also, statisticians show consistency of statistical tests
yeah.
and all that.
No, yeah, okay, but that seems to me go more into the direction of saying, well, it's all super idealized, but at least we can give universal methods in this idealized set, where we do. Work with infinities. And then I would say that these arguments show that even in this super idealized case, it's just impossible to define such.
So I have a question about the ordering, because all we actually need for Occam's razor is that if we have two models, we want to know which of the two is simpler.
Yeah.
So is it possible to have two universal compressors give the opposite results?
Up to any finite points, anyway.
Right, so if they're in different classes, then I will get the correct answer.
Sorry?
You talked about these order classes.
So if I look at the order of complexity of a sequence.
Yes.
Right?
So if they're
yeah.
in different orders, then I will always get the correct answer.
So it's basically a matter of how fine-grained it is. So basically the observation there is that for any finite sequence, anything can happen. But if you look at the growth of the sequence for a fixed compressor, then that is kind of uniquely determined, whatever universal machine you choose. Yeah.
But But I could have specific.
But it is compatible with any finite sequence getting any value. Yeah.
So and then if physics is finite, you could say that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Possibly order physical models.
Right.
According to Occam's razor.
Yeah.
It's more about, I don't know if this is a question or what, I'm having trouble just understanding the big picture and the motivation for this. Is the idea, so the picture is you give me a string of ones and zeros and I'm supposed to be look at them and predict the next.
Yeah.
And it could be, say, an ASCII encoding of Shakespeare's works, or it could be CMB data, but you're not
right.
going to tell me what it is.
Right.
It could be anything. I think the answer there is just no.
That's impossible.
Tell me what this data is about. Yeah, I mean, that's what any actual scientist would do.
That's right. I completely agree. Yeah.
So this seems to be coming from a very strange starting point that is almost as far as possible from any prediction task in actual science.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. I mean, that's basically the sort of philosophical point that you always need to make inductive assumption. And this project of finding a universal prediction method is kind of trying to deny that. But I agree with you, and that's the motivation to show why this doesn't work. Because
okay.
I think it's kind of accepted wisdom that here there is this algorithmic information theory that does seem to be able to give, and I don't think it does. So, yeah.
So I know I'm the chair and I shouldn't do that. So let me just quickly say one thing.
Yeah.
Because I kind of disagree, I think, on some points, and we should probably
Good.
Talk more about it later.
Good. Yeah.
One point now. I guess Occam's razor in itself is an ill-defined concept.
Sure.
It's just a
sure.
hand-wringing idea.
Sure.
So yeah, of course, I should take simple hypotheses more serious than complicated one. But then clearly it's not clear what you actually mean by that. And different languages spoken by different scientists
sure.
will assign different simplicity to different objects.
Yeah.
So maybe what we learn here is not sort of failure of that method to capture simplicity, but more we learn how far it is actually possible to talk about simplicity in a well-defined way.
Yeah.
So that you do get this
yeah.
kind of relativity, but at least all these methods would agree
yeah.
on that sequences, infinite sequences, for example.
Yeah. No, I agree. I mean, I would say in general that negative philosophical points can always be seen as sort of positive points of how far you could actually get. So that is. So yeah, no, sure.
Okay, let's stop here. I think we have more questions in the audience. Then was Mike, and then was next. Maybe Mike first, and then Lee.
So I just have a general, just very general question, right? So what if somebody was to answer that? Look, the goal is to give, for example, in the first case, the goal is to give a universal prediction method, and I have. And I use a lot of induction, and it works. It works for everything that I need, everything practically that I need to work for.
But I can
and
give
therefore,
you.
Therefore, I've met the goal. What would you answer to that?
So, in that case, I would say just take the mixture over the computable elements, and you have something that is actually stronger. And does the same thing, right? So what I take the Solomonov-Levin project to also want is to give some sort of reasonable definition of prediction method, so that it should also be kind of reasonably effective. If it's just about an idealized method that...
No, it's not about idealized. I'm saying like, so imagine that I'm an AI researcher, right? I'm trying to develop some machine learning.
Yeah.
And I'm using this method, and it works for the things I need it to work for. And it
yeah.
works well enough, in some sense of well enough, for the things I need it to work for.
But already saying using this method is a very strange thing to say in this
okay.
setting, because it's so extremely idealized. Again, up to any finite point, this method would say anything. It's hard to see how it can be useful. It's really an asymptotic. Method. And if it's just about that, then I can give you sharper methods, namely in just a mixture over the computable methods that doesn't need to take all those weird semi-computable elements.
Just a question, to what extent are these methods, I mean, methods based on universal priors used in AI?
Sorry? Sorry, can you repeat it?
Are they widely used? I thought they were widely used in artificial intelligence, methods like, based on things like Levin priors, and is this...
Yes. I find it hard to say. I am myself really from a very theoretical computer science background, and there it's the mathematics is very beautiful, and it can give you a very good way of thinking about more practical things. So in that sense, it's useful. But I don't think it's the case that people are actually using variants of this algorithm in actual applications. It's too idealized for that.
Maybe one last question? No, that's thanks all again.